Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. It's amusing to look back at the scaremongering films of the 1950s, like Reefer Madness, in which the viewer is warned how smoking marijuana turns one into a psychotic maniac, and laugh. But are we any better today, with moral panic over issues like same-sex marriage, teen abstinence, and gays in the army? Such questions are the province of Gilbert Hurt, Professor of Human Sexuality Studies and Anthropology at San Francisco State University. He's been in the country delivering some public lectures, and he joins us now. Well, look, you're in New Zealand talking about the lessons we can learn from the last quarter century when it comes to moral panics about sex and sexuality. Shall we start by defining exactly what's a moral panic?
It comes from British sociology about 30 years ago. And it refers to an episode, event, or person that comes to represent a danger to society. And it can be anything. But the fascinating thing about this is how it has morphed into becoming more and more about sexuality. That seems to have become increasingly important. And in my country, in the United States, we've seen an epidemic of sexual panics over the last few years, typically surrounding issues such as abortion rights, sexuality education or abstinence only. Homosexuality is very prominent. A lot of issues surrounding homosexuality and religion. And, of course, most recently, the debate about marriage rights in the United States and other countries.
Is it something where you say where there is a danger to society? Is it a perceived danger or an actual danger?
In a way, perception is most important. I'm an anthropologist, and it's what people believe. It's what they fear. One of the foundations of moral panic appears to lie in the emotions that people have, feelings of disgust, of shame, feelings of revulsion. I mean, they're really embodied feelings. And so when you think about that, it sort of cuts off their rationality before they can really make rational or logical decisions. And the concept of panic, I think, is apt in capturing that, except in one respect, and that is that when you look at these panics over time, it appears that there is a systematic logic to them, and that they do tend to encapsulate and then capture other kinds of events and are swept into one another. And so, for example, currently with the sexual abuse controversy in the Catholic Church, all over the world now it appears that there are a variety of different incidents in which the church appears to have systematically covered up what happened to these victims. Whether it's true or not, you know, often these are very contentious issues, but now the perception is that there was a conspiracy of some sort.
Because panic does seem to indicate an overreaction, doesn't it?
It does.
So, I mean, for example, in the Catholic Church example that you raise, one could say that panic is not actually an overreaction. It's justified given what's going on.
That's true. And so I think we have to focus on what is the result, what is the outcome. And what we are concerned with in the book that I edited, which is called Moral Panic, Sex Panics, it's an NYU Press book, was to see how these panics systematically deprive people or strip people of their rights, their sexual, their gender, reproductive rights across time. And so if you instill a concept that someone can only have full citizenship when they conform to a certain ideal of society, that is to say that they're heterosexual, they're married, they have children, and so on, then you really get into a situation where people can be robbed of even the right of existence.
Would you characterize what we've seen recently, the sexual panics that we've seen, particularly in the US? I mean, is this something that's characterized by an ebb and flow over the years, where we have the permissiveness of the 60s and things, you know, the conservatism of the 50s and so forth? Or are we actually pushing towards something?
It's an extremely important question. I don't know the full answer. But what I can tell you is that you can go back into the early 19th century and you can begin to see panics of this kind. I mean, for example, the disease of masturbation. Masturbation was viewed as a disease and was typically perceived to be something that small boys would engage in. And so beginning in the 1820s, 1830s. But there is a sense throughout the 20th century that there was an increasing number of panics. I mean, think, for example, since the 1970s or 80s. I mean, you used the 60s, which was also the beginning of the civil rights movement in my country, the beginning of second wave feminism, the gay rights movement, and so on. But at the same time, you can see that there was an increasing number of incidents where people were actually afraid of or accused of a variety of things. And it seems that sexuality has become more and more important. And one of the questions is, why is that? And I think it is that sex is something that really sells in the media. And the media itself is sometimes plays a role in what one might call not exactly orchestrated, but opportunistic examples in which panics sell press or copy advertisements. They, you know, get people elected to office. They make people famous. They sell books and so on and so on.
So you say the media perhaps have a role in hyping up the hysterical reaction perhaps sometimes. I mean, I'm thinking a good example that I can think of would be the Super Bowl costume failure, where we were all, horrified, of course. But were we horrified, and how much did the media sort of hype that up for its own purposes?
It's a very good question, but there was some significant results. I mean, the major companies that supported the Super Bowl, that some of them pulled out. Others, there was an urging on the part of some conservative legislators to pass new laws and so on, you know. And because someone's breast was exposed, and from I didn't see it myself, but from what I gather, it was actually quite a nice breast. I mean, it wasn't a revulsion breast.
Talking about the ebb and flow versus sort of pushing a boundary, I mean, in New Zealand, for example, homosexuality was legalized in the mid-1980s. I don't think we had any homosexuals before then. I mean, Iran has no homosexuals today, I believe. Is this like the civil rights movement in the 1960s, where, okay, you've got to get past something, and then once you get past it, it takes a while, but eventually we will reach this utopia where everyone is equal?
Well, I don't know if we'll reach utopia. Nirvana lays, you know, far on the horizon. But I think that your analysis is right. I do think that gay civil rights in my country, I can't speak for New Zealand or Australia, this is one of the defining moments of our time. And it is, again, it's about citizenship. It's about rights. It's about, do we consider people full persons? And for whatever combination of very peculiar reasons, this is now highly pivoted on marriage, on the right to be married. And before I came over, I was Googling to see what is the current situation with New Zealand and Australia. New Zealand does allow civil marriages, but not full gay marriage. But it doesn't have a federal law that prohibits marriage. And I know that your former prime minister had once spoken to the general sense of saying that perhaps it would be a good thing. And unlike Australia, there is no law in New Zealand that prohibits adoption by gay couples, which is a very big heated issue in some countries.
How do you separate panic from a society, you know, validly discussing its views on an issue such as gay marriage?
In a democracy, what we hope is that people will try to appeal to reason, that they will pursue law, that they will not that their actions won't result in lynchings or mob rule. In a democracy, we hope that people will be able to talk about facts and not opinions. And so I think that whenever we have contentious issues like this, there's always a matter of, do we allow people a full forum to express their opinions? Everyone's entitled to their opinions, but they're not entitled to change history to accord to their opinions.
What about abstinence? This is something we hear a lot about in the US. Again, what's wrong with promoting it? I mean, surely if it worked, the idea of teenagers maybe just holding off for a while, let's just say a 16-year-old, you know, someone who's legally in this country allowed to have sex, we just say maybe just hold on for a bit.
What the scientific research shows that all things being equal, if people have been well-educated about sexuality, if they feel comfortable about their own body, their own sexual feelings, then they're able to make informed, rational decisions which protect themselves and their partner and accord full respect and dignity to both partners. If they are deprived of real sexual literacy and they're not able to make those informed decisions, sometimes they'll get drunk, sometimes they'll use drugs, sometimes they'll engage in sexual risk behavior, which really is deleterious to their health. So we do know that abstinence, when combined with full sexual education, real education that tells people what they need to know, that can be quite valuable. But on the other hand, when someone's deprived of the knowledge that they need and the emotional language to be able to talk about things in a real way with intimate partners, then we know that's a formula for all kinds of trouble.
Getting worse before it gets better in the U.S.?
Well, we have a new president. We have a new era we've come into. And it appears that the United States is a highly polarized society. The sexual panics appear at the moment to continue to go on. But there's some way in which there appears to be a greater platform for democratic reason. And so I'm hopeful.
Thank you very much for coming along.
Welcome.
That's Gilbert Hurt from San Francisco State University. Coming up after the break, turning an underground cartoon into a hit online, and the music of Night Choir.